Okay. Thank you, Amanda. Good evening and welcome to the Kitsap County Planning Commission for meeting for January 7th, 2020. It's 5:30 p.m. Welcome, everyone. We have a full house. We'll begin, as always, with introductions. My name is Kim Allen. I'm the chair this evening, and I represent South Kitsap.
Joe Phillips, North Kitsap.
Good evening. Rick Shattuck from Central Kitsap.
Jim Swenson, South Kitsap.
Mike Elias in Central Kitsap.
Amy Mull, North Kitsap.
Ed Galloway, South Kitsap.
And we'd like to welcome Ed. This is his first meeting, and we are very, very grateful to have you aboard here and look forward to your input. You want to tell us just a couple of things about yourself?
Sure. Thank you. It's an honor to serve with all of you on this board, this commission. So I look forward to serving with you over the next few years. I'm fairly new to the South Kitsap area. We moved there from the west east side, excuse me, a few years ago, and wanted to get involved in the community. So I applied for this commission and hope to serve as honorably as you all do. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. Okay, with that, we'll move on to adoption of the agenda. We have an addition to our agenda that was added late, which is the election of the chair and the vice chair. Amanda, our parliamentarian, assures me we can put that off to the second meeting of the year to give people an idea of, you know, submitting their names and or nominating, you know, others. I've been the chair for a year. I am entering into the year 2020 anticipating the arrival of my first grandson. And so I will be very busy with work and with that new responsibility as well. So anyone who has been sitting longing to be the chair, now is the time. So, but if there's no objection, we can put that off to our next business meeting to give everyone a chance to think about it and write their stump speeches. Okay. Okay. All right. So we will, let's see, we will postpone item C until our next regular meeting. Do we have a motion to approve the agenda as amended in that way?
So moved.
Okay. Is there a second? Any discussion? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Opposed? Passes unanimously. All right. We will move on to item D, which is approval of the minutes. And we have a note here that that would be also postponed to our next business meeting. Okay. Moving on now to general comment. This is the time in our meeting where the Planning Commission welcomes input on items that are not on our agenda for this evening. I understand that there are some folks here that have some comments on the Port Gamble matter that's on our agenda tonight and are not available for the public hearing on the 4th. I would welcome the testimony that you give, but I also want to caution you that it will not be part of the public record for the Port Gamble matter when it's delivered tonight. This is just general comment, and it does not become official. If you want to be on record, I would recommend that you would write up your testimony and submit it to the county so that you would be a party of record for that particular hearing. That being said, if you want to come and talk to us tonight with the awareness that this is not going as part of the public record for the Port Gamble matter, please come forward. Please state your name and spell your last name for the record.
Just like at a Rotary meeting. My name is Frank Tweeten, T-W-E-T-E-N. I live at Port Orchard. I live in Port Orchard, 338 Beach Drive. And in the comp plan, I've had a piece of property down in Manchester that I've been trying to develop since 2003 when I bought it. And I met with the commissioner in 2007.
Excuse me, I'm gonna interrupt you for a minute. Are you, your testimony is on one of the comp plan amendments that's before us tonight?
Yes, it's called okay. Centers. It's a new word that I saw in the latest thing that they've clarified Manchester as a center.
Okay. Well, I'm going to stop you right there because this is not the public hearing on the comprehensive plan amendments yet. We have another item on our agenda before that.
Okay.
So if you just hold your comments until we open the public hearing.
Are you kicking me out of the house? When am I coming back?
In just a few minutes.
Okay.
We just have another agenda item before you.
Okay, I'll be right here in the front row waiting, okay?
Okay. Does anyone else wish to speak to something that is not on our agenda tonight or the Manchester or the Port Gamble matter, recognizing that you're not on the record for that? Good evening. Please state your name and spell your last name.
I'm John Rose. I'm the president of Olympic Property Group, and we're the real estate arm of Pope Resources, and I'm here to speak about the Port Gamble matter. So there's some changes in zoning that are in front of you tonight, and I want to just give you a little bit of a preamble about those changes and kind of the road that we've been on. This year marks the 25th year since the mill shut down in Port Gamble. I don't know how many of you, I know Jim, Mike, Randy, if we're here that long. I don't know how many of the rest of you were, but that's the last company-owned town in Puget Sound. And when that mill shut down, it obliterated the whole economic purpose of owning a town. It's not really good to own a town. At the time, there was a big push in the community to save 85 blue-collar jobs. That was the number one concern is, what are we going to do about those blue-collar jobs? And we had an EDC back then, and they rallied a lot of folks to say, we've got to keep this working waterfront working and get the sawmill and get industrial back down there because it's our only working waterfront. Well, that was 25 years ago, and a lot has changed. A lot has changed. And even the Squalum tribe was hoping to get some new jobs at something new at the mill site because they had employment through the whole history of the mill. But a lot has changed, and a lot has changed in the world. And we are less of an industrial society in North Kitsap than we were. That was kind of the last big industrial presence up there. And since that time, our company has spent $35 million cleaning up Gamble Bay and cleaning up the town. That cleanup resulted in opening about 5 miles of our shoreline to shellfish harvesting. That was a great result. We worked with the community in North Kitsap and ended up, through the Kitsap Forest and Bay Project, putting 4,600 acres into county ownership, including the 3,600 acres directly south that we used to own as a tree farm. And so the whole world has changed out there. And what we want to do today is recognize those changes, that it's time to formally say goodbye to our industrial past. Nobody wants to open up a new sawmill after they have cleaned up industrial waste for 20 years. That's just that's not in the cards for us or anybody else. It's not of interest to our neighbors, I'm guessing including the tribe and other neighbors on Gamble Bay to do industrial. And now we have a major visitor attractor in the North End, and that's the Port Gamble Heritage Park, which is 3,600 acres and a mile and a half of shoreline. And so this legislation will help us move from that industrial past and recognize that we have more of a lifestyle and visitor-oriented future going forward, like mill towns in New England, and port towns all over that have converted and still keep their bones as their history, but the industry has moved on. And it's time for Port Gamble to do that, and that's what this legislation does. It trades our heavy impact past for kind of a kinder, gentler, more visitor-oriented and lifestyle uses for the future that you see popping up around. So I hope you'll support that. It's been a long haul for this company trying to steward that place. It loses about $350,000 every year. The company has stuck with it. It could have ditched it, and it did not, and it's tried to do the right thing. This legislation is really important to help us take the next step to get the thing, you know, rejuvenated and productive again, but in a new way. And during the presentation, I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to comment on items that are not on our agenda this evening? Please state your name for the record.
Hi there. I'm Lisa Horn. I'm the Executive Director of West Sound Wildlife Shelter. And I have some brochures for you, which I will bring to you after. We've been in existence since 1999 on Bainbridge Island. We started in the backyard of Gil and Jan Bailey, and we were taking care of animals in their garage. Laws changed, regulations changed, and we became a real full-scale facility in 2001, and we were put onto the property at the Bloedel Reserve. We have operated perfectly, had a great time there, raised a lot of animals, let a lot of animals go, and in 2006 we found out that there was a plan through the Bloedel for their master plan to develop the property, which we were leasing, which left us in a hole and needing a place to find a new home for. Not such a big, it's a huge task for people who have a lot of animals to consider, a lot of caging to consider, and also you can't just put them anywhere. We have animals that are very fragile. We take care of anywhere from 35 to 40 bald eagles a year. We take care of animals. This year, I guess we ended almost close to 1,600 animals. And the goal of the West Sound Wildlife Shelter basically is if you find an animal in your yard that's injured, you can call us, you can bring it to us. Our goal is to get it better and put it back out to the wild. This year we've been very successful with almost an 82% release rate, which is about triple what the national average has been. So we're very proud of that work. But the problem is now we've been on 4.5 acres on Bainbridge Island. We had to find a new home, and that new home, thankfully, to OPG, has been found up in Port Gamble. And it's a picturesque, absolutely perfect place for a wildlife shelter. It is private. It is quiet. It allows the animals to not have the human interaction that can cause problems for them when they go back out to the wild. Essentially, when animals come to us, they need to remain wild, and they need to go back out to the wild. And they need, because otherwise, if they're too habituated or have too much human contact, then they become they can become a problem, or it becomes dangerous for them with humans. So when we started looking around and looking at Port Gamble, it was the absolute perfect spot for us. It was quiet. Our animals can be taken care of. Our volunteers have a nice, quiet, private place to be with them. And I think it's actually just the perfect spot for us. In addition to that, we also do education. So we reach about 20,000 children a year with our programs. And so for us to be able to come up there and have this quiet, perfect spot for animals where our animals are very, very removed from any public is going to create a very positive experience for animals that are in our care. So we're just asking that we be in allowed use in Port Gamble, which is interesting because we are not a vet clinic. We are not a school. We're none of those things. We fit into a very specific niche, and that niche is we rescue and rehabilitate animals that are injured, that are sick, or that are orphaned, and our goal is to always get them back out to the wild. And so I just ask that you please consider us being an allowed use in Port Gamble. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, yeah. Sure. Okay. Please state your name.
My name is Mike Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R.
So is my husband's name.
It is. Yeah. Hi. Where have you been?
Coincidence.
So I want to thank you for letting me speak here. Over the last 5 or 6 years, I've become more and more involved with West Sound Wildlife, starting from volunteering to own a construction company. We built rapture cages and just been a part of West Sound Wildlife. Through that time, I've seen what they have, what they've done with the small site that they have. With this, I feel that with this new proposed property, or property we're picking up from OPG, will certainly allow us to expand in an environment that allows us to not only rehabilitate, but while the raptures, while the wildlife heal, they will be out in an environment that's natural to them, the elements, the smells, and just allow us to allow them to heal without fear of whatever elements they might come across out in the wild if they were not rehabilitated. So this facility is such that there are there's nothing to fear. They would be out in the elements that they love, and which is really big in this part, because we're trying to let them heal on their own. For those of you that are not familiar with West Sound Wildlife, or just the impact that they make on wildlife, in the last 2 years alone, they have rehabilitated bald eagles alone, nearly over 70 bald eagles, and rehabilitated and released. So I really hope that you will consider this a facility that's important to all of us, important to nature and the surroundings around us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And again, I urge the speakers from the animal, the West Sound Animal Shelter, to submit remarks into the record for the hearing on the 4th.
Hello, my name is Fawn Harris, H-A-R-R-I-S. I am the hospital manager and education coordinator for the West Sound Wildlife Shelter. I just want to touch a little bit on what we do as a shelter. So as they talked about a little bit before, we treat over 1,500 wild animal species every year. We have an amazing release rate, higher than most of the other centers here in Washington State. Our release rate this last year in 2019 was 82%. That's higher than most domestic animal shelters. So I really want to emphasize the important work that we do. Not only are we one of the few wildlife rehab centers here in Washington State, but we're the only one in Kitsap County. We treat patients from Bremerton, Paulsbow, Kingston, all the way out to Pierce County, Thurston County, Mason County. We're one of the very few operating centers. So with getting the opportunity to expand, to do more things, there's really amazing environmental work that we can do here. In 2018, we released a critically endangered animal species. It was the northern spotted owl. In our mill talks here, we might be a little familiar with them, right? So, but we were able to actually rescue one and release it back into the wild. And there are very few of those individuals left, so that just kind of goes to show you the really important work that we do. Not only do we are we able to treat all these wild animal species, but also we have a huge education program. We take our non-releasable animals to schools and venues throughout the year. We've traveled all over Washington State, even to places in Oregon, where we present natural history programs to small children, to the general public, anywhere basically that invites us. And every year we see over 10,000 individuals with our education programming, which is amazing. That type of opportunity does not exist here in Kitsap County. There's very few places that you can get to see a wild raptor up close and get to learn about its natural history, what it does for a living, and the importance that it has to each and every one of you. So I really just want to emphasize the really, really important work that we do. We're out there, we're helping educate in schools. We get lots of grants to go to elementary schools, high schools, present our programming. And it's super important that we have the opportunity to continue to do so, because that type of opportunity doesn't really exist around here. And we've really done really great things, not only in Kitsap County, but other counties. So with that being said, I just hope that you guys allow us the opportunity to be able to build and to be able to treat and release more wildlife patients back out into the wild, and to continue to allow our education programming to grow.
Thank you. Are you also speaking from the animal shelter?
My name is Linda Barry Mare. I'm the project manager for Port Gamble for Olympic Property Group. Just wanted to keep it pretty quick, but wanted to let you know my background, my involvement in Port Gamble came initially as
Can you move the microphone a little closer?
Sure. My involvement in Port Gamble area came initially as a volunteer. Got to know John here and Eric Baker working on the conservation project about 12 years ago, and that has really created a unique opportunity for Port Gamble. When I got hired by John, I managed the Port Gamble cleanup, which was a very big, very complicated, and very expensive project for the company, which was paid completely completely by private dollars. But I think that, you know, my biggest challenge here managing the project for Port Gamble is trying to find a future for Port Gamble. It is a really unique place. My educational background is I'm an architect with a historic preservation background. Port Gamble is a business loss on an annual basis. It really is important to have a new future for Port Gamble, and the zoning code that we have right now really needs to be tweaked with these changes to be able to allow that. And what we're talking about doing is very specifically doing things like giving up the heavy manufacturing zoning on the waterfront that nobody wants us to do, but also picking up the ability to do agritourism and outdoor recreation focused businesses up in our agricultural district. And there's a lot of other small specifics. We'd be glad to answer any questions, but all these little details and helping West Sound Wildlife fit in the boxes that is a county code are really important for the future of Port Gamble as well as the future for the wildlife shelter. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, with that, we're going to close this item, general comment, with, again, a caveat that you need to submit your testimony into the record to actually have it be recognized. Moving on, we're going to go to our work study on Port Gamble legislative amendments so we can hear some of the details from Eric Baker about this project.
Greetings. Thank you very much. My name is Eric Baker. I am with the Kitsap County Commissioner's Office. I'm the policy manager. I've been working on the variety of Port Gamble projects over the course of the last 10 years, but what I'm here tonight to discuss is a series of zoning amendments to Title 17 related to the Port Gamble town site, as well as the rural land directly adjacent to it that's in between the town site and our newly acquired Port Gamble Forest Heritage Park. The purpose of all this, this is a limited area, more intensive rural development, which when it was established in 2000 was intended to be revisited every 5 years to assess whether the code is appropriate, etc. It really has not been revisited since 2000. We made some changes to the code in 2007, 2008, but that is about it. So Kitsap County started working on, again, much like Manchester, Suquamish, et cetera, that we update these codes. But at the same time, as some of the people earlier discussed, both the property owners as well as the Port Gamble Sklallam tribe have been having a lot of conversations about what the future of Port Gamble is. And I'll go into a lot more details. But the main purpose of this is we have a historic town developed in 1853. We want to maintain its historic preservation. It is a National Historic Town by the Department of Interior. But we want to be able to marry it with 21st century environmental protection. A lot of money has gone into the cleanup of the bay. We know a lot more about the environment today. And we want to make sure that we're able to marry the two together. And this code is an attempt to do just that. This is amendments to the zoning code, so Title 17. It only applies, as I indicated, to the Port Gamble town site and the immediate rural area. It has no implications to anything outside of the geography that I'm going to show you here in a moment. We're not proposing any zone changes. The zone boundaries all remain the same, and there are no comprehensive plan changes or comprehensive plan amendments necessary. This is strictly a development code applying to zoning, and I'll cover all the various things that we're looking at. The revisions are to development standards, allowed uses, and permit processes for these areas. So I'm pretty certain a lot of us know where Port Gamble is, but Port Gamble is located right there off Highway 104. I will use the... It's located right here. This is the Hood Canal Bridge. All of this land that you see south of it is all owned by Kitsap County. That's the 3,500 acres that we've discussed, as well as an upcoming mountain biking ride park that has just been funded by the Public Facilities District. This is, again, has a lot of details, which I'll come up with in a moment. Here's a kind of a blow-up of the area that I'm really focused on when I say the town site and the adjacent rural area. Pretty much everything that you see in the town site itself, and then this rural area here is the area that we're talking about being impacted by these codes. So as we're going through and taking a look at it, this is the geography, and I'll explain exactly how the code limits it to this geography. So going back, a lot of this has kind of already been said by some of the people who have spoken previously. The Pope and Talbot Mill began in 1853, so we're talking about something that's been a part of Kitsap County for more than 150 years. Before that, it was a previous Native American settlements. So it has a history even beyond the Caucasian presence. It was a robust mill town through the 1980s. It provided a whole lot of jobs, not just to the Port Gamble-Skillalem tribe, but to Kitsap County residents as a whole. That mill shut down in 1995. Pope Resources, who owns the property, was kind of looking at what its future could be. We've had a lot of conversations through the comp plan in the late 90s as to what Port Gamble really was. It's not really a city. What exactly was it? Pope Resources actually went to the state legislature to get a classification of a rural historic town in the actual Growth Management Act. It's a type of limited area of more intensive rural development. I will use the word Lambert from now on because that's a mouthful. But it is the only one in all of the state of Washington and is intended to protect the historic character of the town. It is a Lambert, like Manchester, like Suquamish, like Keyport, but it is different in that when you are establishing allowed uses, you look back over the course of the entire history of the property, not just like the other Lamberts, 1990 is the magic date. You look back at what the uses were, what the intensities were in 1990, and that's what Manchester, Suquamish, and Keyport were allowed to be. This is a rural historic town, entirely different. We can look back all the way to the 20s, 30s, when, again, there's a huge, robust nature. You're not just looking to an arbitrary date and time. Here's some of the pictures that you can see from here. Basically, when we go, I'm going to go back here quickly. What I meant to indicate here is that there are three main zones in the town site. This is the waterfront zone. This is that industrial zone that was spoken of previously. That's where the mill site, all the heavy industrial uses in the use table allow. There is the commercial area that is located just up the hill. That provided a lot of the services to the town. And then the yellow was the residential area, which included the actual residents of the town itself. So we're talking about three zones inside the town itself. So when you're talking about exactly what the use of this looks like, anyone who's been up there recently is looking, and they don't see much now. A lot has been done, so it's really kind of hard to remember exactly what this used to be. The picture in the, I guess what would I call the northwest corner, is the 1940s. And this is that whole industrial reality that used to be the the mill site, and then the commercial up on the hill, and then the residential that you see through there. Pictures throughout the town, this is the historic character that in many ways we're trying to preserve in this area. Yet we're, again, in the 21st century, we're trying to allow it to grow, to prosper, and to be beneficial to both county and the residents of that area. So looking at the current issues, I kind of mentioned that the code was developed in 2000, modestly changed since then. A lot has changed. We've changed definitions. We've changed allowed uses. There have been piecemeal revisions to all of Kitsap County code since. This is the first real review of Port Gamble code that's happened in the last 20 years. We've gone through, and as I indicated, the titles and definitions have changed over time. One thing I want to mention in this is when we're talking about all the codes and we're talking about densities, the town is still capped at a total number of dwelling units. We are not proposing new density. We're not proposing new population. We are actually looking to pull industrial uses out of this area and make it less intensive on the waterfront. The number of dwelling units are capped at 295. That is not going to change in any part of this code. And those three are pushed across the three zones, the waterfront, commercial, and residential zones. Yes?
How did we come up with 295, Eric? Is that infrastructure?
That was largely the capacity of the sewer plant at the time. So that's where we ended. But in the infinite wisdom of the planners at the time, that 295 was pretty much split up amongst the acres, which roughly came up to about 2.5 dwellings per acre. And those were split up across the waterfront, across the commercial area, and across the residential area. Well, the industrial area really didn't have a lot of ability to use these residential units, yet they're all locked into this waterfront zone. So you have 295, and then you have a zone that is not intended for residential uses. That creates a current problem if we're looking to do something other than industrial. I think someone else had a question. Anyone else have a question? Okay. We also want to ensure that we are looking at complementary rural and agricultural uses in that land that's wedged between the town site and the ride park and the county park. This body and the Board of County Commissioners reviewed the agricultural code a couple years back and made a number of changes to it. Agritourism is a big component of Jefferson County, Mason County, and a number of other areas. Kitsap has taken a large step forward with that agricultural code. What we're trying to do here is we're trying to ensure that that area is able to take those kind of foundational elements of agritourism and provide a few additional opportunities for wineries, for breweries, for things of that nature that, again, are going to benefit the people who are using the Ride Park, a regional destination, and folks who are utilizing the town site as well. So the document that you have before you looks big and thick, but anybody who actually went through it and was looking for underline and strikeout, there's not a lot of underline and strikeout after you get past the first six pages. But we always make sure that you have all the code that we're changing so that you have it for context. So again, big, thick, but the changes are somewhat minimal. What I wanted to do is I kind of wanted to walk through some of these. The first element is when we look at the code amendments, as I've indicated repeatedly and probably will say another dozen times, this only applies to the Port Gamble town site and the area immediately around it. How do we do that? Basically, what you'll find in a lot of the code changes here is that the changes only apply when you are developing a town master plan. What's a town master plan? It is a master plan for the Port Gamble town site and the adjacent area. It's not allowed anywhere else in Kitsap County. We have master plans, a master plan process that's allowed for other parts of the county. That's not what's referenced in this code. So all these code changes are locked in by the concept of a town master plan being the thing that allows these changes to become real. So again, we're focusing solely on Port Gamble and the rural area that surrounds it. A town master plan is currently under development by Pope Resources. I'll cover that a little bit more as some of the concurrent processes that are going on along with these legislative changes. As you can see, the number of folks here for the West Elm Wildlife Shelter. Kitsap County Code as a whole doesn't really define a wildlife shelter. As they indicated, they're not a veterinary, they're not a agricultural use. They probably don't need to be allowed outright. There's probably a number of things that need to be considered along with it. So the code that you see here provides both a definition and where a wildlife shelter could be allowed. And again, this is largely focused on Port Gamble. So this provides a definition, not currently in code, but also provides allowances in the zones that are in the rural area predominantly, but have a little bit of the town site as well. Actually, I believe the proposed site for the West Sound Wildlife Shelter is three different zones, a majority of them rural. Again, the idea is that they have kind of a urban front. And then the back of the property is where you have the animals that are able to stay in a relatively pristine, undisturbed area while they heal, like they were described. So there's a lot of opportunities for wildlife shelters in here. It's pretty much paired with veterinary clinics, but is called out separately because it's not a veterinary clinic. It doesn't have the trip generation. It doesn't have a number of the other aspects that a veterinary is going to have that you're going to need to apply conditions to. So it's important to provide that distinction. As we're kind of walking through, I guess, how is it best for me to walk you folks through this? I have the document in front of me. I can call out page numbers as we're moving forward, or I can just stay at the kind of this more 15,000-foot level that I'm standing at right now.
Either way, I have my notes by page.
I had some questions.
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Would you prefer we interrupt you as you're going through?
Please do. Anytime you want me to clarify or you have a particular comment, we'll just kind of start moving through the documents. One of the key components in a lot of the changes that you'll see here is that the way that the code is established is there's town development objectives, that these are kind of the core concepts that the town is supposed to be based around. And the majority of that is focused on historic preservation and a kind of a viable town. Those town development objectives are kind of the lens that all uses are looked at through. But there is the question of exactly who is kind of providing input on these development objectives. Planners are really good at certain planning aspects, but we're looking at historic preservation in certain ways, we're looking at architectural considerations, and we're looking at site design. Some of those need some additional review. So some of the changes that you see through here is the clarity on the fact that there will either be an architectural or site design consultant hired, or there will be an architectural committee established. Kitsap County has done a series of committees over time, and we have had kind of a hit and miss of keeping them stocked with people, as the need for them doesn't pop up quite so often. So sometimes membership lapses. As we know with a number of projects, a lapse in not having a committee available takes time. Time costs money. Money hurts projects. So we want to make sure there was a clear option that a consultant could be hired. That consultant is to be hired by the department, not the applicant, and is to help assist the planning department in reviewing permitting permit approvals in this area, again, looking at architectural site design for historic preservation and adherence to the town development objectives.
Eric, why would that be a cost that wouldn't be passed on to the applicants?
Oh, it would be passed on to the applicant to pay, but we are the ones who are selecting the consultant.
Just trying to clarify that.
Oh, no. Definitively, the county will not be paying for it. We'll be selecting the individual so we can ensure that it is someone who meets the necessary. Or there is, of course, the committee that could be formed, and that's another option. Any questions on that topic? Yes, sir?
Well, just generally, you talked about stakeholders helping with this. On specifically the use table, what stakeholders did we have that helped put together the updated use tables?
The updated use table has been a combination of county staff, not really stakeholders, the Port Gamble Tsklallam Tribe, the Suquamish Tribe, Pope Resources, and a number of surrounding neighbors. We also had some feedback from the Kitsap Economic Development Alliance as it applies to rural uses, tourism uses, and things like that.
So I don't know if it fits in here or not. So we've got a permitted use of a restaurant high capacity, a fast food restaurant. So we've got McDonald's wants to go into Port Gamble. That's a permitted use now. And so they would come and say, well, I want to do a McDonald's, and we'll scale it and make it look like it fits with Port Gamble, something like Leavenworth McDonald's. Is that the kind of concept we have?
And there are certain things that would be allowed or not allowed. The drive-through elements in certain areas are removed. The drive-in, apparently two entirely different things as I was going through that developing this code, also would probably likely be removed. It would be treated very much like a sit-down restaurant. There is no prohibition against chain restaurants in this, but they would be treated like a go in, get your food, go out, not drive through necessarily in a number of the zones. So as we're looking at a town master plan, the idea of a town master plan is that they're planning everything at one time. You're not worried necessarily about as much piecemeal development. So when we're looking at things like parking, we are giving them the opportunity to focus on, again, the historic character of the town isn't necessarily everybody had cars. So we are really looking to try to minimize the amount of visible parking that you're going to see. We want them to be able to have the opportunity to develop a parking plan, basically saying, okay, we're going to park on a number of the streets. The streets are allowed to be private roadways as well as public roadways. We have public road standards. We do not necessarily have private road standards. This provides clarity that there's on-street parking that is allowed on both public and private roadways. The roadways are allowed to be developed at more historic standards. Our roadway standards are built for certain types of engineering. We don't necessarily need roads engineered at that manner. So these private roads are going to be allowed for a more compact design that's more akin to the historic character of Port Gamble. But both of those parking plans and road design plans would all be developed with the master plan. So we would know up front exactly what all that looks like. There is a current draft environmental impact statement that takes into account these types of design characteristics. that looks at all of this. So the idea is that the town master plan tries to provide as much predictability to all of this. So as you look through this and say, okay, well, this looks like flexibility, that flexibility is in the guise of a town master plan where we're looking at everything at one time. So I'm moving now past page 5.
Okay, let me
please.
Go ahead. Just jump in.
I don't have any current conflicts of interest, but I will mention that I've had a lot of relatives that have been employed by Pope and Talbot over the years, and I've spent a lot of time there. In fact, on my way here to the meeting, I was thinking back when the Hood Canal Bridge went out. I used to be able to ride my bike from Lowfall clear to Port Gamble and shop and not meet one car. And of course, that's changed over the years. I'm glad you mentioned clarifying the parking, because I know with the other Lamrids, most of them, Keyport, Suquamish, et cetera, prohibit the on-street parking. This is going to be a new change for Port Gamble, and I was concerned about the visibility, and a lot of jurisdictions put a lot of landscaping and other requirements in place to mitigate the impact. But obviously, we're just putting in the enabling language in it now and approving it, and then it would be up, like you said, to the master plan of the site to be able to negotiate between the company and the county exactly what that entails and what it's going to look like, because we can't see that at this point.
And additionally, all entirely correct. The thing I do want to make sure that the code that we're writing here is not written for Pope Resources. Pope Resources was a stakeholder that worked on it, but again, we had a series of other stakeholders. This is a code that would apply to anybody who develops this property. It could be the town master plan that's currently under consideration, but there is no guarantee that that is what's going to be there. We do have certain additional illustrative opportunities that I'm going to show here a little bit in a moment. But again, when you're looking at this code, staff is coming forward with this as a good idea for a national historic town, and really a good idea for a number of rural-related uses to be able to provide a level of predictability. So when staff brings this forward, it isn't so the West Sound Wildlife Shelter can go in or that Pope is able to develop as they're looking to. This is really looking at a suite of codes that is good on its face, regardless of who came forward. So the town master plan does exactly that. It allows us to get that kind of clarity up front.
So, Erica, just a couple of questions. One, yes. the definition of wildlife shelter is not specific to the chapter on Port Gamble. That will be housed in the greater code,
yes,
to facilitate that use in other parts of the county.
Potentially so.
Okay. And then I noted on page 2 that in the rural historic town waterfront, that residential uses, which you currently don't have in those zones, as you said, would be allowed as part of a town master plan. Would they only be allowed through a town master plan? Okay, because it was not entirely clear if that was prescriptive or not.
Yes.
Okay.
What page are you jumping to?
I'm on page 2.
I didn't want to jump ahead of them, but I got
No, I was moving on past page 5.
Okay, mine's page 7.
Okay. some of the other things is obviously, as a historic town, there may be some desired deviations from signage standards. Obviously, we want this to maintain kind of a historic character to it. There are certain aspects. I guess the example that I'll use is that landmark signage is usually required to be on the building itself. But as you note, when you go up through the town site, sometimes the building is way back from the street. There's a historic building. We're not looking at tearing down the whole place. We want to be able to put landmark signs up by the sidewalk so people who are walking by can look at that and they're not walking up to somebody's door and so that they could read, hey, built in 1872. That type of signage that is separate from the building would not be allowed under current code. So, much like parking and roadway standards, they would be able to do a signage plan for the entirety of the town site to show how they are going to meet or not meet the current sign code, and when they're not meeting it, why they're not meeting it, and they can be reviewed along with the town master plan in one big chunk. On page 7, we're looking at, again, the private road standards. I think I've already kind of covered it along with parking. The two next are a little more complicated, the first of which is noise. Obviously, what you're having here is you're having a kind of a robust town. The commercial area are going to have restaurants. They're going to have drinking establishments. They're going to have a number of things like that. So when you're looking at the town itself, and now when I say town, I'm not talking about the rural area. I'm talking about this geography in black. What they want to make sure is that the folks who are moving into the residential area, or anybody who's living in the waterfront zone, even people living in the commercial zone, they're going to be residential structures. But they will have some ability for the commercial uses to still have some of these more robust nighttime activities. So what it allows is it allows a very modest change in the amount of decibels that can be emitted from the commercial zone to the yellow and the gray on this map. Again, these are folks that are going to be sold to in the future. These are like, these may be notices to title. These are going to be things that they, when they buy the property, they know. But it does allow for the commercial area to be a little more robust. Doesn't make them shut down at 10 p.m. Allows them a little more flexibility for restaurants and bars and things like that to operate. But again, this only applies to people who live inside this area. Anyone who lives outside the black box, the current noise standards apply. So there are no additional decibels that are allowed to be emitted into any of the green areas or across the water into the reservation. Only from the commercial area in pink to the gray, the commercial area to the yellow, and that. It is a little bit complicated, but we had tried to find a way for this to work a little better than some of our other urban areas that have the restaurant or bar surrounded by the residential areas, and the bar struggles if they have live music, and they struggle if they have some other elements.
Is the county noise ordinance 10 p.m.?
10 p.m.
Okay, and what is the ordinance? I didn't look up City of Bremerton, Pauls, but what are the cities?
Most of them all adhere to the same statewide standard. I don't know absolutely, but I would be surprised if they deviate substantially from the state noise standard, because our code is almost mimics what's in state RCW.
Yeah, I wonder if any of them go to midnight.
That's something they could bring forward for the public hearing.
And I know you do notice the title and let new purchasers know, but let me tell you, they're still going to complain. If you want an example of that, go to Whidbey Island and look at all the people that moved in by the jets, and they're filing lawsuits as if they didn't know there was a runway there. So it's going to happen, and especially as you build out. That would be my biggest concern, especially in the highlighted areas, once you get that much density in there. Anyway, it's something to look at.
Yep.
But I can understand at the same time. I know John's not going to want, we're going to be approving to be able to have a circus, but I'm sure he's not going to run a circus till midnight, are you, John?
It's already been a circus to this point.
Yeah. Well, and I can't complain too much. When I was chair of the Viking Fest, I let the entertainment go past midnight, and it was one of my biggest regrets because half the town was ready to kill me. So
Eric, can you, for the next meeting for the public hearing, provide us with what the county numbers are for decibels, and if you're allowing more and that sort of thing. And I concur with Mike that, you know, some sort of notice that things are different in this neighborhood is a good proactive approach.
Yeah, we can do all that we can, but yes, there are going to be the folks who then, like, I did not know, but we are going to try to do everything we can for this. Moving down, there's the concept that on the next page here that is associated with it's a concept of reserve tracts. And I'm going to go to a map here. This is for illustrative purposes only. This is the current master plan, or one of the alternatives that's being considered as part of the town master plan area. I put this out here. I remember the town site. Hey, look, skip to the end. I'm certain you wish that this is what had happened. Right. So again, we're focused. The town site itself is this whole area up through here, and then all of the remainder of this is rural. One thing I want to comment when I'm talking about changes to the rural area, A majority of this area is high-value wetland, streams, etc. In this illustration, you'll note it as open space. It is something that is entirely intended to be protected. So when we're talking about rural areas affected by this code, please note the critical area restrictions on this property already. Honestly, when I'm talking about rural allowances, I'm talking about this small area right up through here and this area right down through here. Our mountain biking ride park located right down here. So as we're kind of walking through this, as they start developing this area out, again, as I indicated, there are a series of Native American settlements. There's also a series of historic artifacts that likely could be found on this. We have historic preservation and cultural resource regulations that need to be applied. So there's an entire possibility that as they start building this, they are going to find cultural resources in this area. When you find that, you have a few options, one of which is you can continue to disturb the area and catalog everything properly and make sure that it is provided to the appropriate place, or you can leave it alone. I think in a lot of ways, not disturbing cultural resources, something that is incredibly important. However, they want to have the opportunity to develop those lots. Let's say hypothetically there are three lots that are affected by this. They don't want to lose the three lots. So in this diagram and in this portion of the town site, there is a thing that we are calling reserve tracts. Those are lots that are not planned for development unless the developer chooses to leave some of the lots alone because of cultural resources or some other reason, in which case then they're allowed to move those lots up into this area. They still have to meet all the town development objectives. They still need to meet all the historic preservation opportunities. They cannot exceed densities. They need to maintain that. But this area through here is set aside for up until the time of build out to ensure that if there are cultural resources that they have the option of not disturbing them. If that does not come to pass, all these lots are developed just as they are laid out in the town master plan, this area then reverts to rural residential uses only. So it isn't. They don't get to double dip. They don't get, we built it out over 20 years, now we're going to develop this out, it's still within the town site. So by rural residential, you're looking at 5-acre zoning, and you're looking at uses associated with the rural residential zone.
So Eric, how close is the town to the 295 cap?
Using this as an illustrative example, they're like 20, 30 lots off. But again, that's just this illustration. 295 is the overall cap, regardless how it gets developed. So let's say they think that there's residential and there's the opportunity to develop down here, but they find cultural resources. These six lots are likely impeded by cultural resources, and they really prefer not to disturb them. Mm-hmm. They're close to the shoreline, etc. It makes sense to leave them alone. Those six lots could then be developed in this area here. That would occur until such time as build-out occurs, where 295 is built, the commercial area is built, it's done. In which case, then, the owner of this area would then be allowed to conduct rural residential uses.
Okay, so those are 295 dwelling units?
Dwelling units.
Okay.
Real quick question. Yes. On the reserve,
mm-hmm.
If we hit cultural resources there, what happens?
We've done a lot of work on the cultural resources there. They will either A, need to be cataloged, etc., or B, they will need to be left alone and that area will not be available for it. So there is not an extra place for if they find it in the reserve to move them to. It's a risk that they may take, but a substantial amount of cultural resource analysis has been done. And we believe that area is largely safe. But again, we'll find out when you start digging dirt. So any other questions? We're now moving out of the Port Gamble town site section where a majority of the changes are, and there are just a number of use changes. The first set you're going to note is all the rural residential area, and there's just a few uses I want to highlight. You guys can point out any others that you want, rather than hitting on each and every one of them. The real changes don't get until you get into page number 12. Here's where you start to see, and again, we're focused on this. When we talk about rural area, we're talking about this rural area is really what we're looking to focus on. These are areas that allow for some additional rural uses. Brew pubs and conference center is what you see appear here. They are affected by a series of footnotes. Kitsap County is filthy with footnotes. We have this big use table, and then we put footnotes on everything to describe it. It seemed like a really good idea at one point. Back in the days when we had use tables for every zone, we used different words for every use. No one could tell if they were a brew pub or a bar or a drinking establishment. They all said the same things. This was supposed to correct that. As you note from the other process you're going through associated with updating the use table, we're going to be making some changes associated with that as well. But these uses will require a conditional use permit and carry with them some footnotes. Footnote 103 and 106, and then also 104. So if you turn to page... and if I hit one more button, I'm all the way back to the beginning, and you don't want that. You'll note that these footnotes are the ones that actually attach them to the town master plan, and one that's developed pursuant to. But when you start getting down to some of these, like when you're talking about conference centers, we're looking at footnotes number 104 and 106. 104 says, allowed only within the boundary of a town master plan approved under such and such, on parcels of 5 acres or greater in size, with setbacks 100 feet from all parcels not included within the boundary. Basically, what does that mean? That means if you're going to have a conference center, say, there, the parcel needs to be 5 acres in size, and needs to be 100 feet from the boundary of the town master plan. If you look at footnote number 106, which is 106 is the one that applies to the brew pub, 106 is allowed only within the boundary of a town master plan, and where such uses are secondary to a primary agricultural or recreational use of the property. Again, if you're growing something on site and you want to have a small cafe, and you'll note that we even limit it further than that. Recreational use of the property and shall not exceed 50 total seats, and or 5,000 square feet of gross floor area. Again, we're trying to allow for small cafes, small brew pubs. People are growing hops on site. They want to be able to have a brew pub there. They're able to do that, but under very strict limitations. Those are not the limitations of our urban areas. Our urban areas allow brew pubs and conference centers much larger. These are intended to restrict them to particular lot sizes, to minimize impacts to people outside the town, and also to ensure that we aren't getting a TGI Fridays located. Again, nothing wrong with TGI Fridays. They're a perfectly fine place, but a larger destination.
Taking a page from King County and the Woodinville kerfuffle.
A little bit. Looking at those footnotes, those are some of the ones that are impacted. So I just kind of want to show how the use table works and how the footnotes work in concert with the use table. I can go through more, or I can just see if any of you have any particular questions, with the idea being you're going to have many more opportunities to drill down on particular
I do have a question.
Yes.
On page 25, when we get to the the Lammard, lines 102 and 104, we have, or 100 and 102, ADUs are not a permitted use in the waterfront area. Accessory living quarters versus ADUs, what's the difference?
Accessory living quarters are attached to the structure, and dwelling units are separated.
Okay. I see you're requiring notification to the tribes?
Yes.
For that as well? What's the thinking there?
The thinking there is after speaking with the various tribes, they obviously are looking for notification. Again, historical and cultural resources are incredibly important to them. Obviously, every project has to go through those. That being said, the local tribes may have knowledge of the site beyond others. They have really been pushing for more notification. Generally, they're notified of all, I'm now going to use planning speak, and I apologize for that up front, type 2 decisions and above, which are pretty much administrative, hearing examiner, legislative decisions. What this footnote in 108 does is it requires it for it requires it for type 1 decisions, like building permits in certain instances. Accessory living quarters would be one of those examples, and accessory use or structure would be another one. It continues to go, and as you note through this section, there's a lot of 108 popping up, directly attributed to permitted uses.
So would an ADU be considered a dwelling unit under the 295 cap?
An ADU would not be considered under the 295 cap, but would factor into sewage treatment capacity.
I see. It would require a CUP.
Yes. Nothing's different than how we handle it normally. So are there any other questions as we move through the use table? Any particular uses you want to call out? Yes, ma'am.
Could you speak to manufacturing and, so this is page 21.
Thank you.
Manufacturing and fabrication light.
Yes.
That seems like an interesting addition.
What we have here in a number of situations, so we're looking at manufacturing. Say somebody has sheep, and they want to shear the sheep, and they want to create blankets, fabric, something of that nature on it. That is not necessarily a straight-up agricultural use. That's a manufacturing use. So we attach footnotes to it, 104 and 105. And if you go back to page 54 and 55, you'll note that the footnote attached to that is allowed only within the boundary of a town master plan, and where uses are limited to the manufacture of agricultural products. So it's not going to be a software development, but software construction or something like that. It is really focused on, this is intended to kind of be an agricultural area, but we want to make sure that you can have a little more robust opportunities for manufacturing, cafes, brew pubs for breweries, for people growing hops and things of that nature, wine tasting for wineries, etc.
What about the daycare? Are there any intentions? Because I noticed that was a change too from some of the other Lamrids. I can't remember. I don't have it in front of me if it was permitted or conditional use.
Daycare center no changes were proposed in the rural area. But let me move to the.
Yeah, in the waterfront area, it's prohibited.
Yeah, it's prohibited. Yeah.
One moment. Almost there. Wait, what page?
That's on page 30.
That's right. Right.
Oh, there we go.
Sorry, I withdraw that. Oh. It was P.
Okay. Right. Yeah, so, but your question still is, why are daycare centers not allowed within the waterfront zone?
Yeah.
That is through discussions with all the various entities, that's the proposal that they made associated with it. It is something that, again, I don't know exactly how much residential we're really planning for the waterfront zone. So the daycare, I think the idea was that it would be located in the commercial area or upland. But again, that's the type of thing that can be further discussed through the public hearing. I wish I had a better, I'm kind of shocked. I don't actually have a strong answer on that one.
And I guess I understand the daycare center per se, but family daycare is also prohibited in the.
Yeah. And obviously, the difference between those two, full daycare center is
it's
one that you see in a commercial area. Family is the people who are having five kids stay at their place. So I think those are two things that would be good for consideration as we move towards recommendation by this body. Dog ear. Any other uses we want to talk about at this point? This is not a speak now, forever hold your peace type of thing. Let's see. I don't think there's any other footnotes I want to highlight here. Well, we'll skip on to, we talked about reserve tracts. We looked at the map. I flipped through here a few times. We talked about allowed uses, we talked about rural uses and the limitations associated, we talked about tribal notification. We're now moving on to density flexibility. This goes back to, again, we're not cresting 295, but when we created the code, we created a strict 2.5 dwelling units per acre in all three zones. Obviously, the waterfront zone, doesn't necessarily have, it didn't have that many opportunities. So what we're looking to do is, again, as part of a town master plan, we're going to allow those 295 units to be moved around the three zones. So say there's 10 acres on the waterfront zone, that's supposed to be 25 people or 25 units. Those 25 units, 10 of them can go to the commercial zone, but the historic preservation needs to be maintained. We're not talking about huge five-story apartment buildings. You need to maintain that, and you need to maintain the integrity of the town development objectives, which again is maintaining historic character and all the other aspects. So the density may be able to be moved, but it needs to be consistent with historic character of the area. So it just allows flexibility.
Do you have a height cap?
The height cap is located on page, I believe we're looking at page 57. The height cap located through here, it roughly looks like 35 feet for the commercial zone, 30 feet for the residential zone, and 35 feet for the waterfront zone. But there is a footnote 22. And let's take a look and see what footnote 22 tells us. Maximum height should be 35 feet when located within 200 feet of a shoreline area.
Okay.
So that's what it all currently reads. Any deviations from that as projects come forward would be associated with variance processes, etc. All those still apply. So that covers density flexibility. We now move into the agricultural code. The agricultural code, one of the areas that it wasn't quite as specific on is equestrian events and riding arenas. A lot of people who build riding arenas oftentimes come out and have events located at it. It wasn't particularly clear, which means we didn't want to prohibit it, but we didn't want to necessarily allow it to be a huge long acres size type thing. So what we changed throughout in a few areas, we defined what an equestrian facility was. I will flip to the proper page so I can. Sorry about this. We are looking at page. Okay. Let's flip to page 80. 81 is the one that pretty much indicates exactly how many events you can have. On page 81, it indicates that as part of a town master plan, 16 or more events may be allowed a year without, but they can't be more than 6 days apart, and it needs a conditional use permit. Yes?
Most of the riding events, or at least English type riding events, are three-day events.
Yes.
And so with this wouldn't preclude a three-day event.
Oh, no. It basically just indicates you can't have a three-day event, and a three-day event in 9 days. You have a three-day event, 6 days apart, three-day event, 6 days apart, so that there's some kind of breakdown. And I will also note there is one other relatively entertaining, yet it's the way that we elected to go forward. If you look on page 80, there is, when we're talking about tasting rooms, basically we're now talking about wine, etc. We wanted to ensure that glassware, we have a glassware limitation on this so that a tasting room doesn't become a wine bar, or a brewery tasting doesn't become a brew pub without going through a conditional use permit. So I'm always trying to look to see how someone might use a loophole to work your way through it. It's like, yeah, I'm growing grapes, I'm making wine, and now I have this large wine. I have this large wine bar. Like, no, it's supposed to be a tasting room. So the long and short is that those are the predominant changes that you see through here. But I just want to kind of hit on the process before I wrap up. We've coordinated with the property owner at length. We have had review by the local tribes, specifically the Port Gamble's Glown Tribe, which is located directly across the water. They have indicated they have no objection to the amendments as proposed. And then we're in the middle of Planning Commission review and recommendation where we expect public hearing and appropriate changes moving forward. But there are two other concurrent processes that are moving along with this that aren't coming to this body. That is the Master Plan PBD application and draft of environmental impact statement for the town site. It is out and it's currently being reviewed. The hearing examiner will be the person who makes the recommendation on that. Along with that, there's also a development agreement that is going along with it that really addresses vesting of the project. Generally, vesting of preliminary plats is only for 7 to 10 years. This is obviously a much larger project. It's going to take more time. That development agreement is really looking at a 15-year horizon. 15-year is the hard cap, no extensions. Basically, they all have 15 years to build out the town site. And then lastly, this will be a recommendation from the hearing examiner. Ultimately, the Board of County Commissioners is going to have to make the decision on both of those bodies. The Planning Commission will have the role in the legislative amendments that I've presented to you today, but will not necessarily have a direct role in this, though, of course, they can participate in the hearing examiner process and the Board of County Commissioner process as you feel free as private citizens.
Real quick, could you show us on the map where the recreational vehicle camping parks could be?
That would be located anywhere within the rural residential areas. So again, we're talking about down
here. And
you
mentioned that those areas that are similar to the surrounding areas, which is 1 unit per 5 acre.
Yes, those would also require the 5 acre minimum lot sizes. For
okay. Such. And then last thing, I noticed too, compared to the other Lamrids, you're giving them, which I think is great in the whole project, is you're giving flexibility and you can work through it. However, my fire science side's coming back, and unlike cities where you have nearby fire stations, ISO ratings, et cetera, and can get there quickly with paid professional staff, your paid station is going to be Pioneer Hill Road. Mm-hmm. And then if they're not available in the city of Paulsboro or Kingston. So, you know, you're looking at several minutes, and with a fire doubling every couple of hours, I'm a little bit concerned about some of your adjustments to the lot width. And I guess the question I have is, in your discussions with the company, have they talked about their intentions? I mean, how many on the single family detached versus how many of them could end up town, like a townhome style, where you have, you know, wall to wall?
I think there may be some of those. We have, of course, talked to the current owner of the property. Looking through the code, looking at through the lens of the code is the code, regardless who's going to move forward. Obviously, any kind of development of that area is going to have to follow fire code. Likely, if you're going to be doing some of the adjoining properties, you may be looking at sprinkler. You might be looking at sprinkler systems. Generally, a lot of these are historic homes, and retrofitting those can be particularly challenging. I think we would largely be leaving that to the permit processing at the time and following fire code that's in place at the time that occurs.
Yeah, I'm mainly referring to the new creation of the new lots and the new construction.
Yes, I think
that, obviously a lot of new units connected to each other.
Yeah, and I think as the fire code would apply, once you start connecting them all, you're going to have a greater possibility of needing sprinkler systems than if you are having them separated. But lot widths is something that our fire marshal takes a very close look at and is reviewing in this as well.
Great, thank you.
Any questions? Anything else for us, Eric?
No, I greatly appreciate your time. I apologize, this was not the most fluid presentation that I've given. It has some ins and outs. If anybody has any questions as it comes up, please contact Amanda, and she will relay them to me appropriately, and I can make sure that I am prepared to answer any questions, so that we have as few of the "I have to go back and talk to blank" when we actually get to deliberations.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we'll move on to our public hearing on the 2019. Is it 2019 comprehensive plan updates or is it 2020?
I will let them answer that question.
What? It's still 19. Okay. All right. I'll defer. The 2019 comprehensive plan amendment update. Peter Best is staff on this, and I have him give us a brief overview before we open the public hearing.
Good evening. For the record, my name is Peter Best. I'm a senior planner with the Department of Community Development, and tonight our sole focus is for a public hearing. Since there are members in the audience here to testify, I'll do a brief overview of the comprehensive planning process in general, and then the 2019 amendment process more specifically. I have about 10-11 slides for that. Then we'll open a public hearing, and it's the first of 2 days. The second hearing will be on the 21st, And that second day has been added because delayed release of the staff report for our final amendment, which is the Dickey Pitt site-specific amendment. That should be available soon. So the comment period has also been extended out to the 22nd of January. On the 21st, just to lay out the rest of the sequence here, we'll close the public hearing, begin deliberation that night. We won't ask for any formal recommendations or findings that night because the comment period will still be open, and we want you to be informed by those comments, but you can certainly begin your own deliberations that evening. And then on February 4th, we'll complete deliberations and ask you to adopt the recommendations and findings of fact that night.
Peter, just going back,
yes.
By January 21st, can you also provide us with any written public comment that you've received as well?
Yes, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. So just a high-level overview of comprehensive planning in the state of Washington. So we do this work under the Growth Management Act and some other legislation that enable cities and counties to adopt and amend comprehensive plans. We abide by those procedures and guidelines very carefully because they are appealable actions by the county. So we're very cognizant of that. These boxes here represent kind of a hierarchical structure to how laws and policies layer on top of each other. So under the state enabling law, we participate in a multi-county process with King, Pierce, Snohomish counties and adopt multi-county planning policies. Currently, these are in a document called Vision 2040. They're about to adopt the update to that called Vision 2050. And those lay out a larger region-wide framework for cooperative planning, in particular around infrastructure and transportation planning, but also cover economic activities and open space and others. More locally, within Kitsap County, we coordinate with the cities and the county representing unincorporated portions of Kitsap County, along with tribes, the Navy, Transit Authority, and others to adopt countywide planning policies. And this is the framework internally within the county that sets up our common planning process and outcomes so that there is some level of consistencies across jurisdictional boundaries. Right? And that's the level at which population allocations and population growth targets are adopted and allocated across the different jurisdictions within the county. And then for Kitsap County, what we're doing here tonight, our local planning, is the county comprehensive plan that applies to the unincorporated portions of Kitsap County, which includes both urban areas, like the Kingston Urban Growth Area and the Silverdale Urban Growth Area as examples, as well as the rest of the rural portions of the county. It does not cover cities, it does not include tribal land, it does not include military reservations. And then our comprehensive plan is implemented through the Kitsap County Code and other development regulations and programs. So the comprehensive plan, when I describe that, it's a 20-year plan that currently spans from 2016 to 2036. It is a very broad document that covers land use, economic development, the environment, housing, human services, transportation, capital facilities and utilities, parks, recreation, open space, as well as sub-area and neighborhood plans that are more specific to local geographies. And then there's a whole host of other documents that are adopted by reference into the comprehensive plan that become part of the compendium of what is the body of the comprehensive plan. So examples are a 20-year capital facilities plan, non-motorized plan, our parks and recreation open space plan, and so on and so forth. And then the comprehensive plan also includes many strategies for how to implement it. And the capital facilities plan in particular identifies the types of investments in public facilities and services that are needed to accommodate and support the growth and the implementation of the plan. So the diagram here represents the current land distribution in the county amongst the different kind of planning jurisdictional categories. So about 25% of the county's land area is currently urban within city boundaries or within the unincorporated urban growth areas. And the rest of it's rural or military. Our plan calls for almost 80% of future population growth to go into those urban areas, both to the cities and the unincorporated urban areas, and only about 21% of future population growth to go into the rural areas. So that's the plan that we're implementing and the plan that these amendments are intended to make minor modifications to.
Can I ask real quick?
Yes, please.
So the old range in the UGAs was 78%, and then it kicked up to 83% with reasonable measures. You mentioned 80. Is it now 80, or are we still within that range?
So so the 2016 plan was adopted under the 70 split, but it actually allocated population on an 80-20 split, and there is a trigger that once we, for a five-year period of time, I believe it is, once we exceed that 70 split, then it automatically rolls up to that 83. So hypothetically, our next major update in 2024 would be driven by that 83% split.
Great, thank you.
Yep. So we do update our comprehensive plan on two different cycles. What we're doing here today is an annual cycle. But there is a larger 8-year review, and there's important differences between these two. So the 8-year review, which was last completed in 2016, is a full review from cover to cover of the comprehensive plan. We look at our growth assumptions, look at new population growth targets that might be adopted, what's happening regionally, what's happening locally, and move our 20-year planning horizon forward. So we're again looking at a full 20 years in the future, and revisions are made as needed. So it's theoretically possible to say, you know, we're on track, everything's looking good, we're not going to make any major changes, or alternatively, this is the time in the 8-year review where significant changes can be made to the comprehensive plan. The annual review is more about incremental changes and better implementation of the comp plan. So it's not intended to be significant modifications to the vision or to the assumptions, but rather more refinements. And this annual review is only opened currently under our current process if the Board of County Commissioners determines that a review is needed. That's the scope of that review is established by resolution of the Board of County Commissioners. And I'll talk a little bit more about how that process happened for 2019. And these amendments we review on an annual basis must be consistent with our existing comprehensive plan. Just to clarify for folks, this is a legislative process that we're involved in. And so the Board of County Commissioners has full discretion over the scoping and the decision-making ultimately on these amendments. It's different than, while there are applications involved in this annual amendment process, it's different than a land use or a building permit application. So the amendment process can be easily broken down into four phases. I'll very briefly describe those four phases and how that happened in this 2019 process, so folks here can understand how we got to this point and what's going to happen from here to adoption. So we begin with collecting a catalog of suggested amendments from staff and from interested parties and citizens, including, you know, Planning Commission and others. The Board of County Commissioners reviews that catalog of suggestions and selects what types of amendments they want to consider in any given year. That's adopted in an initial docket, which was done in December of 2018 for this amendment cycle. At that point, those amendments begin to get developed. And then early on in that process, in the spring, the board comes back as we've learned more about those amendments and can make refinements to what's docketed and what amendments ultimately proceed on to consideration for adoption. In the development process, this is where applications can be submitted if those are allowed in a particular year. In this year, only previously deferred applications were allowed. No new applications were allowed in 2019. And those are developed by the applicants. They can consult with staff as much as they want. There is a pre-application consultation meeting that's required under the process. And then most of the amendments in any given year are county-sponsored. And these are ones that either come from internal recommendations or are recommended by citizens and the county develops. So some of these may have been in development over many years and have seen prior public development on those. An example might be a sub-area plan. We don't have one of those this year, but those might take multiple years to develop before they actually enter the official adoption process that we're in now. One of our amendments, the Downtown Kingston Phase 2 amendment this year, utilized a citizens advisory group to help develop those recommendations. And then others are just developed by staff. Once a full proposal is prepared, we analyze that in two different ways. SEPA, the State Environmental Policy Act, we go through an environmental review and make a threshold SEPA determination about amendments. That's an appealable decision. And we develop staff reports that analyze against the specific decision criteria that are in existing county code. And then finally, where we're at tonight is in the consideration process. So this is what the public primarily sees out of all of this. And it's basically a two-phase process. We begin with the Planning Commission. You've already conducted study sessions on most of the amendments. We have a public comment period and a public hearing. You deliberate, make recommendations, and adopt findings of fact. Those recommendations and findings of fact are transmitted to the department and the Board of County Commissioners. They become the basis for a draft ordinance. And we also update all our staff reports to incorporate your recommendations and public comments and any other further analysis that comes from that work with you. And then we kind of begin that cycle again with the Board of County Commissioners. So there'll be a study sessions with them. The public will have another opportunity to comment, both in writing and at a public hearing like tonight. They will deliberate and then ultimately make a decision adopting an ordinance. In that ordinance, the board has the discretion to deny specific amendments, approve specific amendments as proposed. They can adopt conditions or modify amendments as well. So the public comments that we received tonight and in writing are very informative for your recommendations and then ultimately the board's decision on each of these. So for the public, we tried to have a robust program to inform and encourage participation. We have an online open house that's available from the very beginning of this process all the way through the end and is available as a historic archive. So if people become informed and engaged in this process at any point along the way, they can go back and see everything that's happened to date and have full access to documents and meeting schedules, and everything's there as intended to be a one-stop shop. We have public comment periods. We've completed a series of open houses across the county. We're having the beginning of two public hearings tonight. And when we communicate to the public, we do this many different ways. We're required by law to publish legal notices in the newspaper. But, you know, more direct communication is a better way to reach most people. And so we have an email notification system. We use social media, including things like Nextdoor.com, which is more geographically neighborhood-based system. We send letters or postcards to amendments that are geographically specific, so those landowners and residents are directly notified. And in this year, that included the site-specific application for the Dickey Pit, the Downtown Kingston Amendment, and the Mineral Resource Amendment. Those affected landowners were all directly notified by mail as well. We do a formal government-to-government letter with tribes. So ultimately, we're trying to reach, you know, directly over 30,000 folks in this process. And we recognize that not everybody receives that, but we're hopeful that it's above and beyond legally required and hopefully a robust process. So, yes.
County did a great job with the stakeholder group meetings with the wireless code. I found the information very valuable, especially as we got written testimony from Verizon, AT&T, and the rest of the groups. Very educational as well. I'm wondering, with the public notifications, if the department has had any outreach to the home builders, realtors, environmental groups. Have there been any meetings so far?
In the routine course of engaging with those groups, we often announce major milestone steps and opportunities through our processes. I haven't had specifically direct face-to-face communications or meetings with those groups, but I do know that most of those entities you referenced are in our email notification system, and I'm available to meet with folks if they would like to. Okay. So if you know folks that would benefit from that, I'm happy to meet with them. So then quickly, just a brief overview of the amendments. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but just so folks here who might have come for just one amendment understand the scope of what we're doing tonight. There are five county-sponsored amendments that we're looking at. Downtown Kingston Phase 2 carries on work that began in 2018. The Phase 1 was adopted in 2018. This work is intended to primarily address barriers to achieving the existing vision for downtown, as well as address some consistencies with regional and countywide planning policies. It's a hefty amendment with lots of detail in it, but that's the gist of the driving forces behind it. The center's amendment is intended to designate centers across the county. In most cases, those centers already are designated, and this is formally adopting some of that language into our own comprehensive plan. There is some changes for consistency with the regional centers framework, which is that multi-county process I mentioned earlier that has been changed. And a substantial part of this is about transportation funding, and these locations would become higher priorities for future transportation funding as an important component to this. Another amendment is the association of the Silverdale and Kingston unincorporated urban growth areas with future cities of Kingston and Silverdale. This is expected under existing state law, and this is to address some consistency issues between our own policy language and what's required under regional and countywide planning policies. It doesn't mandate the incorporation or a specific timeline for this. It does envision that within the 20-year planning horizon, both of those locations would incorporate. The mineral resource overlay cleanup amendment is a carry-on to work we did in 2018, where we identified a large number of small parcels with existing homes and buildings that have this mineral resource overlay zone applied to them, which is highly restrictive. And this is to clean up and remove that designation from those parcels that probably should never have been designated in the first place. And the last county-sponsored amendment is clarifying edits, which are intended to be non-substantive improvements in administration and clarity of the code. And then finally, our only site-specific application this year is the Dickey Pit. This is located in the Silverdale UGA. It's 138 acres. Requesting a zoning change from industrial with mineral resource overlay on it. It's a it's now a exhausted sand and gravel mine is most of the site. And they're requesting to change that to an urban low residential zone, which is 5 to 9 dwelling units per acre, and as well as neighborhood commercial on parts of the site, which is 10 to 30 dwelling units per acre. And allows commercial mixed use and multifamily types of uses there.
This is not on our agenda for tonight. Correct?
Right. So this is the staff report that we're about to release soon. So the public hasn't had the benefit of reading that analysis. So that's the second public hearing on the 21st will be the primary focus of this amendment. But if someone can't make the 21st and wants to say something about it tonight,
we'll handle that when it comes.
Okay. So that's the scope of the amendments and the introduction. Wanted to hand it over to you, Madam Chair, for the public hearing. These
Thank
are
you.
The kind of common guidelines that have been utilized in the past, and I'll leave these up here for folks to be able to utilize. Thank you.
Very good. Amanda, do we have a sign-up sheet? Do we know how many folks want to testify here? And I would propose, given the number of folks here, that we limit testimony to 4 minutes and have Amanda time. That is that acceptable?
Maybe to see how many people actually signed
exactly.
up.
Exactly. Yeah. No. Sometimes you can have a whole room full of people and only three that want to actually testify. Thank you for coming out tonight. We appreciate your input and we appreciate your patience and waiting through the first item on our agenda.
Maybe while they're filling that out, we get a show of hands of how many people are thinking they might testify. Give us a ballpark idea.
Yeah.
Five on the list.
Five? Okay. Well, we can 4 minutes, 5 minutes. Yeah. Keep your remarks as concise as you possibly can. You can address one or multiple amendments when you're testifying. When you come up, please speak right into the microphone. Feel free to move it to adjust to your height over here at the podium. Please state your name and your place of residence and clarify if you're providing a general comment or you want to address a specific amendment. If you have any documentation or handwritten testimony, please give it to Amanda, and she will circulate it and provide it to the Planning Commission. And then written comments in this record are open through January 22nd, 2020. So you can follow up if you have things, additional things you want to say after you leave tonight. We're open to comments up until close of business January 22nd. So with that, I'll open the public hearing on the 2019 Comprehensive Plan Amendments for Kitsap County. We have five individuals signed up. Frank Tweeten, thank you for your patience. The microphone is all yours.
Thank you. I'm here to talk about a project that I've been working on for since 2003. And in that project, I had a 9-unit condominium project for on the corner of Spring and Main in downtown Port Archer. The economy collapsed, and the timing of my grandfather clause, I was granted a year's extension, and during that time, the economic environment kind of regrouped, and mixed-use centers fell out of fancy for development in Seattle and the bigger metropolitan areas, and my property in Manchester was zoned mixed use. Well, after a couple hundred thousand dollars in investments in trying to get this thing to go, the 2016 comp plan was updated, and they stripped the residential density from the Village Commercial in Manchester. Now, to me, the Village needs people to survive, and for whatever reason, the MCAC, they didn't like me from the beginning because I was a guy from out of town. Well, I now live at 3338 Beach Drive. I had a couple of businesses in town. I've been in business in Kitsap County since 1976, so it's not like I'm an outsider. During the period, they took away the residential density, and they let me put in a brew pub or a drinking establishment, and I hear that those are a couple of the things that they want up in Port Gamble, but I would encourage you to not allow those on a residential street. Spring Street down in Manchester is lined with residential homes on both sides, except where my property butts up against the restaurant and the tavern that's down below. The rest of Spring Street's all residential. And for me to put a drinking establishment on that street would obliterate the neighborhood character of the street. And I've proposed, my lot is 200 feet wide and 80 feet deep, and I proposed 4 50-foot lots with four 30-foot wide houses, leaving a 20-foot view corridor between the houses. And I've said this, I've been to numerous of these meetings, and my fear is that I'm going to miss one, like maybe in 2016, where the MCAC put together a subcommittee and three or four people gathered in the room and said, well, let's just squash these condominium projects and anybody from moving into the commercial district in Manchester, let's just take the residential density out of downtown Manchester. So that's what became adopted in 2016. And since then, I've been through the DCD, paid $350 to listen to the people cite me the uses in the code. And my objection to all that is I understand those are the uses. My question is, how do we change it? So Sean O'Leary in the Public Works Department, DCD, says nothing happens unless you meet with Charlotte Garrido. So in June 1st of 2017, I met with Commissioner Garrido in her office and Eric Baker and Jim Bulger, who was the, he was just with the DCD, later became the temporary acting director of it when the other guy left. They were at the meeting, and Charlotte said, doesn't the county want to keep that piece of property for something? And Eric Baker, he kind of looked at a puzzlement on his face. And Commissioner Garrido said, well, Mr. Tweeten, I'll have a resolution for you in a year. So in January of 2018, I made an appointment to speak with the commissioner June 1st to see what my resolution was. Well, what Charlotte Garrido had for me was the substance of nothing, and that is it's the absence of something. That's the definition of nothing.
Mr. Tweeden, can you summarize? You're at the end of your time.
Well, have you heard what I've said, that I just want to build some houses and put a couple $1 million on the tax roll? That's all I wanted. I just want to develop the land and be a good steward to the community where I live. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
And by the way, thank you for waiting through all the earlier. That's why I said it was going to be hours.
I didn't mean to speak out of order, but I don't know how this goes. They say if you sign up on the back wall, that you can speak.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And I'm going to mess up the last name, Steve, and we'll let you identify your last name at the microphone.
Good evening. My name is Steve Smoladen. It's nice to see a couple of you board members serving our community, Richard Shattuck and Mike Eliason. I'm an old Paulsville boy. I'm a real estate broker, and we have been looking at the Kingston core area and the zoning, and there has been a restriction against someone with a vacant lot building a standalone single-family residence. I believe that Mr. Best has somewhat assured us that that's going to be removed, and perhaps the question is best directed at him to find out if it appears that that is the recommendation going forward.
That's the recommendation.
Okay. I would certainly encourage it. I represent a family who has been hamstrung with a vacant lot that they need to sell, and we've had buyers, but they're primary intentions are just to have a single-family residence. You can understand the expense of building something larger than that, a mixed use that might include apartments or a commercial use. So it's a very small lot. They're very close to the ferry, and it's a desirable location. So please, as a planning commission, if you would take that recommendation that Mr. Bess is making to you, and hopefully the county commissioners will agree. Thank you for your time this evening.
Thank you, sir. Don O'Shaughnessy?
Greetings. Hey, Ed, how are you? I am a resident of Southworth. I am also the chair for the Southworth Community Coalition. I don't know how many of you know, Ed's a resident there. We have a major problem with, I'm also the chair, so the South Worth FAC chair for Washington State Ferries. We have a massive problem with intense traffic, with those who blatantly disregard the traffic laws and markers that are currently there, both on the South Worth Drive and on Sedgwick Road, and on a connector between the two, Wilson Creek. I'm simply here to ask for Kitsap County's support. I'm working with WashDOT. Our group is working with WashDOT. We're looking for long-term, long-range thinking, which would include non-vehicle modal considerations. This is a community. It's a very urbanizing, very lovely community, but it is rocked by intense amount of what we refer to as those who blatantly disregard. My daughter's bus was hit. That was the bus that was hit a few months ago, where the motorcycle rider. I live on Sedgwick Road in between Wilson Creek and the ferry terminal, virtually right in the middle of what is now a passing zone. WashDOT has agreed to remove that, but that's the lowest hanging fruit. It does not address the problem, which is the blatant disregarders of speed, safety, life, etc. And so we are a community. It includes Sedgwick Road and Southward Drive, all the way to Harper Pier. We consider it all the way through to where Banner hits the waterfront, the original census designated area considered Southworth. So I'm hoping that we can get more flexibility from our jurisdictional leaders and our governance as we process that long-term plan moving forward. It's a community that's going to grow. I am a displaced Seattleite. I'm going to build high rises in downtown Seattle, but this is my home. It's my dream home. And we have a lot of friends and family in the community. And that's simply what I'm here to say. So I hope to, at some time in the future, to have conversations with you about that. I'm meeting with Ed Wolf in several days to address those things as well. All right.
Thank you. All right. Kevin Tisdale?
Got to meet quick. Kevin Tisdale. I am, from Chico. I work for Seattle Public Utilities and Drainage and Wastewater System Maintenance and System Management, and I sit on the BCAT Advisory Board for something or other. My primary concerns are the quality of life in Kitsap County will be dramatically decreased by this density proposal. We also have Bremerton and cities that are adding homes. A lot of commuters, I commute every day myself, so I commute with hundreds, thousands probably, of commuters. I don't know how many, but it's increased over the years exponentially. So all the time.
Just let me interrupt you for a second. Are you speaking to a specific comprehensive plan amendment?
No, because there's so much to talk about, and we have 3 minutes. I'm gonna write.
Yeah,
thank you for the question. I'm gonna write written commentary also and submit that more specific. But overall, in general, we got to be very aware of ruining this county. I grew up here myself. I'm fourth generation, and this density, just the traffic alone, is ruining the county. Any little tiny problem in traffic backs up county, any traffic in the county everywhere, right? I think we've all experienced that. But one of the other problems is just the speed that we want to develop, right? So we'll just take Port Townsend for the moment, and it's supposed to be done within 15 years. I'm thinking more like 30 years. That's a two-lane tiny road, and the traffic that backs up just going across the bridge is incredible when there's a bridge closure for the subs to go through, or even a sailboat. So that's a primary concern I have right now is the traffic, and traffic modeling hasn't been presented ahead of this development. I suspect that developers will develop ahead of the traffic need, and then we'll retroactively address that, proactive and retroactive, right? So those are my concerns, really, is the quality of life that this will dampen dramatically in the county. And I'll just leave it at that for now, and then I'll submit my written commentary. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tisdall. And last we have Cynthia McCurdy.
Talking in microphones. Don't know anything about this process, and I'm not comfortable talking in front of people, but I have a home in Kingston, and I want to specifically say, and I don't even know what amendments they are, but there are two specific issues that I want to address. There are several condo projects in downtown Kingston, and I would like to move into one of them, but they keep getting delayed for years. I've been waiting for a couple years now, along with three friends of mine who would like to downsize and move. There are restrictions that keep weighing in the balance, but hasn't been decided in a long time. One is forced mixed use. So they would force retail on the first level of these condo units. And the other is a height restriction. So I know that the building that I would like is called the Belmont, and they're asking for a 45-foot height restriction rather than 35. So there's two issues, the height restriction and the forced retail at the bottom level. Couple of things quickly. Those are empty lots right in the heart of Kingston. They've been there for years, empty lots. Since I moved there 19 years ago, there's always this talk about we're going to develop these and allow people to have room to live in the corridor. I have dear friends who are business owners. They've been waiting for this. We've been waiting to move here. I have a good friend who's a professional team owner who wants to move in, a UW professor, researcher, an executive. They love downtown Kingston. The Fast Ferry has brought them the access to move here. There's nowhere to move. There's sprawl, there's urban sprawl that's getting approved, but nothing right downtown. I know it's a chicken or an egg thing that if you say, we don't want just residents, we want businesses, then they will come. Well, there's been empty businesses or changeover businesses for years. It's hard to sustain them. So my ask, and I don't know who this goes to, or hopefully it doesn't fall on deaf ears ultimately with the board, but my ask is that if you want to have forced retail at the bottom level on Main Street, like if it faces Main Street, then I understand that. But anything off of Main Street, I don't think you can force boutique retail on the bottom level. You certainly can't force the developers to build if it's not going to be profitable, if they have to go into debt by having the 35-foot and the first level of retail. And lastly, these developers who we're talking about, they're not out-of-towners, unnamed developers. The ones I know are ones my neighbor helped build the Village Green, like literally helped build it. They helped build our local theater, our kiosk retail space on Front Avenue, the new walk on Ferry. These are the developers who've been sitting there in empty lots waiting for this stuff to happen. So they care about our community, and a lot of us really would like to move into town and put more money into the local area. So,
I didn't catch your last name when you came up to testify.
It's McCurdy. McCurdy. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. Is there anyone else that wishes to be heard this evening? With that, we will leave the public hearing open until next week, and invite anyone that wishes to submit any additional written comments to do so. And with that, the public hearing will be open until January 22nd, at which time we will hear, on January 21st, the Dickey Pitt amendments will be before us, but the record is also open for any additional comment on any of the other amendments that we've heard tonight.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Best. With that, let's move on to our administrative update, if there is one. Thinking not, okay. Is there anything else for the good of the order? All right. With that, Happy New Year, everyone. We will adjourn.